Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, March 31st. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome back Jeremy Hurst, the Game Management Section Head for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. He facilitates research, outreach, and management planning for New York's big game, small game, and fur-bearing wildlife. Joining Jeremy today is Dave Kramer, a research scientist with the DEC and the SUNY ESF Roosevelt Wildlife Station for 10 years. His work focuses on moose, deer, and bear. You want to be a part of the conversation today about wildlife in your backyard? Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Jeremy Hurst, Dave Kramer, your wildlife questions coming up right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We're discussing wildlife today, and we welcome back Jeremy Hurst. Jeremy is Game Management Section Head for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. He has been a wildlife biologist in the DEC since 2005, spent the first 17 years of his career coordinating management programs for white-tailed deer, black bear, and moose. Also with us today, Dave Kramer. Dave has been a research scientist with the New York DEC and the SUNY ESF Roosevelt Wildlife Station for 10 years. His work focuses on moose, deer, and bear. He's a co-program lead of the Snapshot NY program. Snapshot NY, monitoring New York's wildlife one snapshot at a time. We'll talk about that a little bit as we get rolling here. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Jeremy Hurst, welcome back. How are you, sir?
I'm well. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, we have lots to talk about today.
It's going to be a good show.
Many, many ridiculous questions for you, and we'll get to them after we meet Dave Kramer, who's a newbie here on the show. Dave, welcome.
Thanks. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
That's good. You don't even have to call. This is exciting. What is Snapshot NY? I went to the website. There's some cool pictures on there.
Yeah, so Snapshot NY is the way that we can monitor wildlife across the state with trail cameras. So DEC will be deploying trail cameras across the state, and the public can as well. So we can access large portions of public land, but we can't access private land. So we're trying to partner with you, the scientists out on the radio, to put out cameras in your backyard and sign up.
Well, before we get into the details, how do people sign up? How do people find out about it?
Yeah, so we have a website. It's Snapshot, SnapshotNY.org. So that's SnapshotNY.org. So go on there. You can see the methods and sign up for a grid.
What do you hope to learn?
So we're just trying to develop indices of population monitoring that don't require hunter harvest. So at DEC, we do a lot of population monitoring that relies on hunter harvest or sighting logs. And we're looking for these measures that for the population that allow us to assess without that bias of hunter harvest.
Now, if someone has a trail cam or a camera in their backyard or whatever, is there a protocol or is there a best practices that the state will give to this person, this homeowner, to say, all right, we want it set up this way so you get maximum data?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a program coordinator, Jolie Tooley. She's based in Cornell, and she has done extensive videos and walkthroughs on how you can participate and the best ways and practices to participate, like how to hide to put the camera or what settings you want to set it on or how many photos.
I think I put a link there on the page for today's show here at WAMC.org. Just look for today's Vox Pop show. Jeremy, you guys castigated me roundly for saying what a lousy winter it was and how I didn't like it. And you said, how dare you? Well,
it was a wonderful winter.
As I stood out in back shivering for several weeks, I wondered, how do these little animals survive? What do they do under 2 to 3 feet of snow?
Did you really have 3 feet of snow?
We had 20 inches, at my house.
Well, either way, it doesn't matter.
Pardon me. I'll get you a measurement.
Because I wanted 3 feet, and we didn't quite get it.
All right. Yeah, we had 2, I think.
It was wonderful. Yeah, but you're right. So a lot of animals have to survive in that space where they're accessing the ground to get food, but they're underneath the snow. And so they live in an environment we call subnivian, sub-snow. And so they may live in that little bit of surface layer of the ground underneath that snowpack and make little tunnels. And so in the springtime, it's really obvious to see this. A lot of homeowners will see this in their yard where there's little raised tunnels or sort of pathways in the grass. And they're probably about 1.5 inches wide and look like an animal's been just making this little runway in its yard. And those are probably meadow voles or moles at some point. And they live by feeding on some of the seeds and that are there in the litter underneath the grass, maybe eating some of the grass stems, and they just subsist underneath that snowpack. And the snowpack provides insulation and still has enough air movement that they can breathe, and they can do quite well.
I mean, in one way, it's probably safer for those little critters, right?
Sometimes, but have you ever seen a fox or a coyote out in a field and they're staring intently in front of them and then they hop up in the air and pounce down? They're trying to catch a little meadow vole or a mouse underneath the snow. And so underneath that snow, you can't see it, but the mouse is just there doing its thing and the fox is keying in on the sound that it's making. And it's studying and trying to locate where it's at, and then it pounces and grabs.
But under 2 feet? Under 3 feet?
Well, you know, it depends on the snow condition, but maybe under 18 inches.
Well, I know that we have seen several birds of prey now circling around, so they must be very happy, and their long overdue chance to get some rodents. Dave Kramer's here. Jeremy Hurst is here. It's Wildlife in Your Backyard and Beyond, 800-348-2551, or email voxpop@wamc.org. So, Dave, your work also focuses on moose. Are you enjoying that?
I mean, who doesn't enjoy moose?
Well, I've only seen one once.
And I bet you enjoyed it.
It wasn't in New York, though. I've never seen anything close to a moose in New York.
Well, you got to spend more time in the Adirondacks.
Really? How many you think are up there?
So we conducted aerial surveys in around 2019 or so to give us an idea of about 650 moose.
That's a lot.
And then since then, we've done some more work where we're collaring individuals to track survival, and we're seeing an upward trend. So our guess is probably around now there's 700 to 800 moose within the Adirondack Park. But as we talked earlier, moose persist along that edge between Vermont and Massachusetts, Connecticut. So there's moose in the Taconic Range all the way downstate into like Wasiac, Armenia.
Do you guys have any projections of what's full moose saturation for the upstate area?
So what you're talking about is what we would call carrying capacity. So it's this theoretical value of where wildlife can persist healthily, like the maximum capacity. In the Adirondacks, we believe that's around 1,000 moose.
Yeah.
But Jeremy can attest to this. These ungulate species, these deer and elk and moose, they regularly persist at or above carrying capacity. So, you know, it's just our ballpark estimate of 1,000, but it could probably be more.
Yeah, the consequence of being above capacity is that they overbrowse the range, and that then creates a situation that's not as conducive to their survival, because they basically eat more food than what is there for the next generation. And so the moose then start to decline in number until the habitat can restore.
So at that point, you would cull the herd somewhat, right?
Well, we do that with deer, right? That's why we manage deer, is to try to reduce the impacts that they're having on the environment and to reduce the impacts that they're having for public. But if we just let deer go and didn't have any hunting of deer, populations would go crazy and the impacts would be outrageous.
But you can't hunt moose?
Correct.
If it hits a thou, will they open it up for a brief window?
So we do not have the statutory authority. So
I'm not saying you, Dave, but I'm saying you think that the people higher up at the DEC might do something like that.
Well, the agency doesn't have the statutory authority to set moose season. So that would require a bill or some work through the governor's office.
So the downstate lawmakers who run the Capitol would then have to become experts on moose.
So one of the issues for moose is that they really thrive in areas where the forests are being managed. You have lots of timber harvest and new growth is coming up, and that creates a lot of food for moose. But our largest moose population, of course, is in the Adirondacks, where much of the land is in forest preserve. And so we're probably going to hit that cap of where the land is saturated with moose before they get too numerous, because much of the Adirondacks just isn't great moose habitat. There's moose throughout there, but it's not such good habitat that the moose populations are going to grow. We're not going to see the numbers that they see in Vermont or New Hampshire or Maine simply because we don't do as much active timber management.
Oh, and that's what makes good habitat?
Yeah, exactly.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Jeremy Hurst and Dave Kramer from the New York State DEC join us. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Anne in Bonsville, who is a loyal listener, a Vox Pop advocate, writes in, I hope your specialists might explain a squirrel anomaly witnessed after a friend and I had been walking at a local reservoir on a toasty day. This is how she recounted it. As I drove out, I saw a dead squirrel flattened on the road ahead. Poor squirrel, I think, as I adjust my wheels to avoid it. But no, at the very last minute, the dead squirrel jumps up and runs to the side of the road. Half a mile later, another dead squirrel in the middle of the road who leaps up, and again. So weird. Why were they resting in the middle of the road? Too hot? I've seen them do that on tree branches and picnic tables on hot days, but never on asphalt roads. And that's from Anne in Bonsville, Massachusetts.
No idea.
Yeah, my best guess would be maybe it's not that they're trying to cool off, it's that they're trying to warm up, that they're getting the thermal residual from the road. Maybe they're laying down. But
or maybe there was an acorn that landed there.
Yeah, or maybe a predator that they're just trying to stay still and hunker down. That's an oddity. Yeah.
So they're lying on the road every half mile, and you guys are all right with that. Just normal.
I don't know. Just
slow down.
So sounds nuts to me. Yeah.
Recommendation for avoiding wildlife strikes is just to slow down. Don't swerve.
Okay. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, honestly, we don't want anybody to intentionally kill a squirrel, right? But
obviously,
swerving creates more risk, either into oncoming traffic or off the road, losing control. Most of the accidents that involve wildlife are escalated if a person swerves.
You know, their reaction time is so insane. If you see one in the road and then you're driving and you slow down a little bit, but you're still moving, these things, they're gone like that.
Oh, yeah. I've seen them skirt between wheels. I've seen them actually fall off of trees and land on the asphalt and then get up and scurry away. So they're very resilient.
Frank writes in, there are certain parts of the Catskills that are known for having lots of bats. What is the best way to deal with an infestation? A friend of mine has bats getting into her attic on a regular basis. Other than creeping her out from time to time, they don't seem to bother her. I never heard of anyone getting rabies anymore. Should she still be concerned, or is the fear of rabies a thing of the past? And that's from Frank.
Well, rabies definitely is still a concern. And so I recommend not doing anything that would involve handling the bats. And in fact, this time of year, we really don't want you to do anything with the bats because there's no alternative for them. If they were released and forced out of the house into the, I mean, it's not so cold today, but next week we might get some cold weather again. You could really put them at thermal stress at a time when they're not ready for it. And so the recommendation for excluding bats is going to be wait until they're naturally moving. And so they're going to leave the house in the evening and forage through the night. And so wait till that, watch where they're exiting, and then close up the space once they're all out. That's fairly easy, right?
They'll find a new place, okay, if you shut them out during the day? And
yeah, they'll find somewhere else.
Number here is 800-348-2551. Yep, let's take a little break here. Dave Kramer and Jeremy Hurst from the New York State DEC are with us. We'll be back, and we'll hit the phones in a moment. Things ain't what they used to be. There's Terry Gibbs and the group here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's wildlife today with the cats from the New York State DEC, Dave Kramer and Jeremy Hurst. Let's grab a call here. And Fred is in Greenwich. Fred, you're on.
Hi. I'm from downstate originally. I lived in Long Island my whole life, and I just moved up here 2 years ago. But I'm a lifelong visitor to the area as a skier, and we had a place in Lake George for half a dozen years in the 70s. So this is something new since I've moved upstate. I'm seeing a lot of beach grass growing along the side of busy roads in the gullies next to the busy roads, busy intersections especially, where a lot of road salt has been applied. And I've been wondering, if I'm seeing all this beach grass from the road salt, what's it doing to the environment, the soil, contamination, and for critters and for crops?
Well, good question.
Dave's looking at me. So good observation, Fred. I'm not sure what you're referencing as beach grass, but often alongside of road edges, there's water from the runoff, as well as, you know, we've got a lot of wetlands in the state. And so you'll see some sedges, which have some similar morphology to what you might be thinking of as beach grasses. But your question about what happens with the salt, it persists, right? So it dissolves and stays in that water body. It can kind of migrate through that water system. And salt can create problems for a lot of amphibians that need to have those wet spaces for their life cycles, and either cause some of those amphibians to not develop right as those metamorphs start to change, or impact the reproductive cycle. So the state and some of our research colleagues have done a fair bit of work on looking at how salt impacts particularly amphibians and how it moves through the system. Beyond that, I can't speak with any great clarity because it's just outside my wheelhouse.
Yeah, Fred, this comes up from time to time during the gardening show, so you may want to ask some of those folks when we do it again. And I think is it next week or the week after? Yeah. Hey, Fred, where are you from on the island, man?
North Massapequa.
So were they, and I know that area pretty well, but were they salting or just sanding down there back in your day?
I'm talking about up here, the roads.
I understand, but I'm just asking as a point of reference, did they sand or did they salt down there, being that the ocean was all around?
Oh, geez, they salt like a steak in New York restaurant.
All right, man. Well, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. Jeremy Hurst is here. Dave Kramer is here from the New York DEC. Before we get to the email bag again and then the calls, Bear, they're now out and about. When did they hit the Albany area? I know down southern part of the Hudson Valley, they've been out for some time.
Yeah, so bears are going to start emerging as the weather warms up. So we're experiencing emergence downstate, and it'll just slowly spread up as spring comes through. So people are going to start seeing bears. So just do things like pull in your bird feeders, store your trash properly. And just, you know, keep an eye out. If you see one, enjoy it, take a picture, and then leave it alone.
Jeremy, is there enough habitat for these away from suburbia?
For bears?
Yeah.
Well, certainly there's a lot of bears that live away from suburbia. One of the real challenges is that bears need to eat a lot. And if we have conditions that don't provide a lot of food in the natural environment, they're going to seek out food where they can find it. And often that's around our homes.
Yeah.
They're going to move long distances to find a food. And so for folks that have been accustomed to feeding birds in the wintertime, we always tell folks, take them down April 1st. Really, this year, because we had a couple warm spells a little while ago, particularly downstate, it might have been better March 1st. But one of the cool things about bears in the springtime is that they will emerge from the den dependent on their sex and reproductive status. And so adult males will come out first, and then you'll have females that had young last year. And so those young that are with her are one-year-old. They'll emerge second from the den. And then the last bears to emerge will be the females that have cubs that were born in the den this year. And so they kind of stagger that way. Now, it's not like they're all sharing the same den. They're all in different dens. But it's just as a general pattern and when these animals emerge based on their life condition.
Give us a description for those of us who have never seen it. What does a bear den look like?
It can be really variable. In New York, we see bears that den under brush piles, in a rhododendron thicket, or in a tree cavity, in a rock cavity. Sometimes I've even seen a bear den in one of those round hay bales. It hollowed it out a space and made its little nest in there. And so sometimes they're just open, underneath a log, in a little ground nest of some leaves that it piled up. It's remarkable to see a female bear have cubs in the sub-zero weather with the only protection she's got is her own fur and fat for herself and fur to protect the cubs, underneath a log and buried in snow. And that's the insulation.
Now, bears are big, obviously. But what if, when they're in hibernation, there is some consciousness, right?
Oh, sure. They can be fairly alert.
Okay. So what happens if another critter, maybe a predator, comes along and they're in this semi-conscious state?
Yeah, they're easily aroused. Not necessarily groggy, but easily aroused during that period of denning. And for instance, we used to do a lot of work where we would go into dens and we would immobilize the female chemically, and then we'd be able to put some tags on the cubs and be able to monitor these bears for their survival and so on. And so when we would approach a den, almost invariably the sow would be looking at you, and it might be inside a tree cavity that we had to go up in there and then inject the drug into the sow. Or in a rock cavity where you have to climb halfway in before you could get access to the female. But they're not aggressive in that state. They are cautious, and so it wasn't a big deal. But if, say, there's a logger that's doing some work and their activity causes some disturbance, she might relocate the bear, the cubs. Or in some cases, say, a spring melt late winter rain might flood out a den. She'll pick up her cubs and go somewhere else.
Dave.
So what we're getting at is, Jeremy's kind of alluding to, is most bears, and especially in New York, don't have a true hibernation. So we think of hibernation as the animal goes to sleep, sleeps all winter, and then wakes up.
Yeah.
But actually what they're doing is called a torpor. So they're in this state of near hibernation, but say it gets really warm and they can go out and forage for a period of time. Or there's a disturbance, like Jeremy said, and they have to move their cubs. So bears here don't necessarily hibernate in the true sense. They do what's called a torpor. So you can come out in and out throughout.
But
winter.
Up further north, they will go in full hibernation?
Not in New York. No,
but north of here. I mean, is there a spot in the world where bears are fully out in hibernation.
Polar bears, grizzly bears, some of those bears do more of a true hibernation in that sense. But it's easier to explain as a hibernation to the general public. But yeah, there's more nuance to our bears down here.
So you say it's a torpor state. Is the alarm or the wake-up call, as it were, just temperature-related? When it finally hits a certain temperature, it's up and go get them?
It could be a mix of things, like Jeremy alluded to, you know, environmental conditions, you know, being disturbed by, as you alluded to, a predator. So it could be a number of things. It's okay. Just more that they're not conked out for 3 months at a time.
Snow depth is a big factor, simply because the snow hides food access. Whereas as soon as we have snow relief, then we start having new plants come up in the spring. We have access to acorns that were left over from last fall. And so the bears have some access to food.
Are bears becoming more aggressive in your view? You guys have both been watching these critters for a long time.
Not more aggressive. Certainly there's a lot of interactions with humans because we have a lot of humans and we have a lot of bears. And the bears know what they're supposed to do, but the humans don't really.
Number here is 800-348-2551. If you want to talk wildlife with Dave Kramer and Jeremy Hurst of the New York DEC, email is voxpop@wamc.org. Let's do a couple of emails and then we'll get back to the phones. Eric in Ulster County writes, I live in the Hudson Valley, where a huge battery energy storage site is being proposed. The industrial-sized project is proposed to create a humming noise equivalent to a highway. What kind of impact would this kind of industrial development have on local bats, coyotes, foxes, birds, raccoons, squirrels, and other local wildlife we now enjoy and fear losing in our neighborhood? We're concerned. That's from Eric in Ulster County.
It's a good question. So, Eric, I'm not sure if I can give you a definitive answer as to how all wildlife would respond. Because, you know, depending on the frequency of the noises, whether it interferes with some of the bats' echolocation, that sort of thing. But in general, what we learn from wildlife is that often they can adapt quite well to our spaces. And so, you know, we have animals living next to highways where there's lots of noise all the time, animals next to industrial spaces where there's lots of noise all the time. And so they just kind of accustom themselves to it. But in this particular instance and the types of noises you're describing, I'm not quite sure how all the wildlife would respond.
Dave.
Yeah, I believe there's been some work, and Jeremy, you could attest to this, in Vermont with like black bears and wind turbines. And there's that initial disturbance as these facilities go in, but generally the wildlife acclimate, like Jeremy says. So it might be a short-term duration, but it would be no different than someone building a house or anything. The general noise and construction work pushes wildlife away, but over time they'll acclimate back.
Bob in Stuyvesant writes, I thought I had read that white-tailed deer carry a disease that infects and is deadly to moose. My understanding was that this would naturally limit the population of moose in New York State. Dave.
Okay, so there's a number of diseases we could be talking about. There's chronic wasting disease, CWD, which Jeremy's more of an expert than I am. But the others are brain worms, liver fluke, and winter tick. Winter tick, we're not too concerned about here. That's more of a moose density-dependent issue that's common in New England, Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire. But for brainworm and liver fluke, without getting too lengthy, basically they're parasites that persist in white-tailed deer as their normal host. They get the life cycle of the brainworm or the liver fluke goes through the gastropod, a snail, and then into a deer and lives its life happy, sheds, and continues the circuit. But when those parasites get picked up by moose, they're generally a dead-end host. So what happens is for like a liver fluke, the fluke somehow realizes it's in the wrong type of animal. It should be in a deer, but it's in a moose. It'll move around, create pustules, and basically damage the liver, weaken the moose. And same for the brain worm. It'll get into the nervous system, the brain, be in the wrong host and move around, and it can be fatal. So there are these interactions where we're experiencing high deer densities and an increasing prevalence of diseases and parasites on moose in New York.
All right, Lisa writes in, thanks for the info about the cameras. That'll be right on my list. Oh, there you go. Snapshot and why. I have two questions, says Lisa. Number one, I live in a place that has wetlands behind me and a golf course with ponds across the street and a stream, the Old Bog Meadow Creek in Saratoga. My question is it okay to put a turtle crossing sign to try and get the traffic to slow down or at least look out?
I mean, that's a great idea, but I don't believe turtles can read.
Oh,
come on, Dave.
Who's your writer? No, but I mean, I don't know. Are you allowed to put signs up like that?
I think they have to start with the town and maybe the DOT.
Okay. Number two question from Lisa. If we see moose out and about, would you all like to know when we and other details, is there a place to register that? And that's from Lisa.
Yeah, so we have a link on our DEC website for moose public sightings. So if you see a moose, please let us know, you know, take a picture, enjoy it, and then let the moose be. But yeah, check out our website on dec.ny.gov and give us an idea of where and when you saw and how many moose. And
all right,
it's always informative.
One more email for now, and then we'll go back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Wildlife Today with Dave Kramer and Jeremy Hurst from the New York DEC. John writes in, I live in a neighboring state. I wonder what that is. I don't know. I hear both shotgun and rifle shots occasionally at night and during times without allowed hunting. I live on a small, dense street surrounded by woodland, both town, state, and private land holdings. The rifle and shotgun reports sound like a legal distance, 1,000 feet from homes. I notify the area's DEA wildlife enforcement officer of the sounds of firearms and its direction from my house to make a record of that activity. What could any enforcement officer do about poaching? Just seems unenforceable to me. And that's from a neighbor.
Yeah, so our wildlife officers are very active in and out of the hunting season to try to track down wildlife violations. And so potentially that's what's going on. But I'll also offer a couple alternatives. There's nothing that prohibits people from target shooting on their properties after hours. And so maybe they have a lighted range, and that could be here, what he's hearing. An alternative also would be, I'm not sure which state he's referring to, but for instance, in New York, we issue depredation permits or damage permits that landowners can remove wildlife legally when they're causing damage. And so that may be for deer that are consuming crops or for other wildlife species that are causing some damage. And so there are legal reasons why somebody could be discharging a firearm after hours.
Number here is 800-348-2551. Wildlife Today with Jeremy Hurst and Dave Kramer. Let's go to Woodstock. Mark, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, this is Mark Montero.
Okay.
I had a simple question. I've noticed in the last number of years, I'm barely seeing any American kestrels on the phone lines and throughout. I live in the Hudson Valley. I wonder if anybody has any idea what might be the cause of this.
Yeah, that's a good question, Mark, and a good observation. American kestrels, they're a beautiful bird. And so it's nice that you enjoy them, and it's unfortunate that you've noticed their decline, because they have actually declined across their range here in the Northeast. This is outside my wheelhouse, so I don't know the specifics. But I suspect that humans are part of that cause, with some vehicle collisions maybe impacting it. I'm not sure what the impacts on their reproductive success would be that are limiting their population growth. I would start by checking out some of the information that's on our website. If you go to www.dec.ny.gov and search for kestrel, we have a webpage that describes their population status. Kestrels are part of our breeding bird survey that that we conduct every 10 years. And so that's a method that's used to sort of track population status of birds in New York. And there'll be some information about that population trajectory.
And Mark, if you want to follow up and ask the question again, I think the bird show on Vox Pop is coming up, and I think it's next week. It'll be on Tuesday, either next Tuesday or the Tuesday after that, with Rich Guthrie and Julie Hart, and they'll have some good ideas for you, okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
Appreciate the call. 800-348-2551. Let's grab another call before the next break. Jeremy Hurst and Dave Kramer join us from the New York State DEC. Let's head over to lovely Post and Kill. Chris, you're on.
Hey, good day. How are you?
Good.
Going back to the moose questions, I live in Post and Kill. I'm up knocking around Cherry Plains often. I've seen signs of moose, but I've never seen a moose. Is there a time of year or a time of day that we're more likely to see moose in the Cherry Plains area? And part B is, I know it's a wildlife management area, so are there certain projects that are being done to invite moose to hang out there? Thanks.
Yeah, so moose are crepuscular in nature, so typically they're the most active in dawn and dusk. But throughout the year, I mean, moose mosey around a fair deal of land. The rut during that fall period, September, October, November, males and females are both more active and may cover more area than normal, but there's no magic time or place to kind of see a moose. As Ray was lamenting, he's yet to see the beautiful New York moose. So I can't give you any key tips to find one. And as far as land cover treatments go, we have our Young Forest Initiative that we conduct land cover treatments in different WMAs, and those can be beneficial to moose, though we're not actively making treatments to target moose.
Yeah, and Chris, I poke around in that country quite a lot too. I've not seen a moose up there yet myself, but like you, I've seen a bunch of sign. And so they're just not that many in Rensselaer County. And so it's going to be hard to find one in person or, you know, for live viewing. But it's good that you're seeing sign. There's also been quite a lot of state land acquisition in that area with some properties that were formerly managed for timber harvest being converted to state forest. And so I would say concentrate your effort this spring on areas that have some new growth from old harvested old timber cuts and look around in those areas.
Chris. Okay.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. So moose just eat fresh grown stuff?
Yeah.
So in the summer, their diets predominantly, they're eating those deciduous leaves, those maple trees, but they're browsing this like 2 to 8 foot range. So they're looking at those early sapling stands is where they're eating the most. They'll eat aquatic veg in the summer as well. But then in the winter, they shift predominantly to balsam fir. They're eating a ton of woody stems and balsam in that winter.
Interesting. Now, when you say rutting, that means they're on the prowl for a little hey-hey. Is that what that means?
What's a little hey-hey?
Yeah. Are they in the... In the early stages of mating season.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. The rut is that September, October, November window. So that's what we call the breeding period for cervids.
Now, I've heard, and I don't know if any of this stuff's true, but the male moose, the bull, what they call it, a bull, right? They can be very aggressive at the time, right?
So moose can be aggressive most of the time. They're more aggressive cows, actually, when they're protecting their calves. So generally, we just encourage people to not approach moose. They will seem kind of docile when you see them at a distance, but they can move pretty quick when they want to. So we just generally encourage people not to get closer.
Please don't mess with the moose. Yeah. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. It's Dave Kramer, Jeremy Hurst, and you at 800-348-2551. We'll check the email bag in a moment. Okay, gardening fans, you asked for it and you got it. We're going to take the Vox Pop Gardening Show on the road. We'll be at the Landis Arboretum on April 22nd. That's Earth Day at 2 p.m. You can be there with us and join us for a live recording. We'll air it, I think, Memorial Day. We'll have the Gardening Show All-Stars there. You can bring your fertile questions. You can dish the dirt with the agricultural experts. It'll be fun. You can find out more and get your tickets at wamc.org/on the road. I think they're going pretty quickly, so you might want to do it soon. wamc.org/on the road. Landis Arboretum, Earth Day, April 22nd. Vox Pop Gardening live and on the road. Right now, we're in Studio A with Jeremy Hurst and Dave Kramer. And the number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Jim in Colony writes, oh, by the way, before we get to the email bag, Dave Kramer, you should know the ground rules of this program. I'm sorry that Jeremy didn't tell you. If you make a noise like an animal, that's top priority on this show. Now, I hear just in the break that you do a moose call. Well, for heaven's sake, lay it on us.
All right, so there's two kinds of moose calls. We have bulls, the males. Most of the calling occurs in the rut, so the males are making this short, guttural.
My kids do that.
Yeah, so they're making those calls to vocalize. They're traveling across the landscape to look for cows.
Okay.
To make a little hey-hey.
Yeah, sure.
But then the cows have a different call. It's a little longer. It's a little nasally. It's a...
Which is moose for I have a headache.
And so it's these calls, they're calling out to the bulls to kind of, you know, moose live in these large spaces, so they're calling out for some mates.
Now, do you guys, at the old DEC, do you ever have cocktail parties at the holidays and just stand around making different animal calls?
We do it every day.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that sounds like a fun place to work. 800-348-2551. Well, thanks for that, Dave Kramer. Jim in Colony writes, as an avid hiker, I sometimes solo hike. I always get asked by people who don't hike, aren't you scared of bears and bobcats? I pinch my fingers together and say, a tick this big scares me more than 300 pounds of bears or bobcats. Do you guys agree?
Yep.
Ticks, it's a bad tick season. What do you guys do to protect yourselves?
Check for ticks.
Yeah. Do you put any repellent on? You
sometimes.
Wear a Seresto collar when you go out there?
No, but ticks are, you know, they're insidious because you may not see them all. And so it's careful when you're in the woods to find the ticks and pull them off. Bears, of course, are scary for a lot of people because they're big But the reality is that encounters, negative encounters with bears in the woods is pretty rare, and we can take steps to prevent that.
Like what?
Well, like make some noise. The bears don't really want you to have an interaction with you either. And so when you're backcountry camping or hiking, doing some food protection so that bears don't have access to your food, and then make some noise so that the bears aren't.
So just crank up some Metallica on a boombox when
you're
camping?
You could do that.
Yeah.
I would recommend not.
No? Okay.
It'll ruin my hiking experience.
All right, fine. John writes in, solar forests. Is it true that there is a bill in the state legislature to allow solar arrays in state forest reforestation areas? Are we going to have solar forests now in addition to solar farms? And that's from John. All right, a political question. Gentlemen, what do you know?
Actually, I don't know anything about the bill that he's mentioning, so whether that exists or not, I can't say.
Okay. I've heard something about this, but I don't know the details, so we'll have to leave that to the WAMC news team, our pack of yapping news hounds. Deborah writes in, with the arrival of warm, wet weather, I expect to see the spring migration of red efts. I typically will gently pick up the eft and help it across the road in the direction of it where it's headed. I worry that the oils on my hands might be harmful. Is this a concern? If so, should I stop giving them a lift across the road? What's an eft?
So, yeah, that's an eastern newt. The eastern newt goes through a red eft phase where it's this bright reddish-orangish color.
Yeah.
And so this time of year, we have amphibians that do these road crossings where they're going, making their way to vernal pools to lay eggs, to breed. And so that's a common activity for folks to go out on these wet, tonight might be a good night. The roads are warm, the roads are wet, so you might see some reptiles and amphibians crossing the road.
Yeah.
And as far as the oils on hands, you know, just wash your hands thoroughly, you know, make sure they're clean, and I think you should be okay. I mean, unless you're, you know, coating your hands in some kind of substance prior to touching the wildlife, you should be okay. But again, this is just reserved for like salamanders and frogs and things that might need a little help.
But those Fs are all over the place in the summer when you hike in the Adirondacks or the Catskills. It's a favorite activity of my kids when we were going hiking to count how many we'd see on a hike.
And what was the top number?
I don't know.
Can you call the kids and find out?
No.
Wow. Number here is 800. You know what, kids? Call Dad. 800-348-2551. We're looking for that information. Let's go to Dean in Ticonderoga. Dean, you're on.
Thanks. Thanks, guys. I wonder if you had some recommendations for people who rehabilitate injured animals. We have a female deer in our area who has been limping around on three legs for the past probably 4 months or so. Seems to be surviving all right, but, you know, I think in the situation that we also have some coyotes around here, and I'm thinking this deer can barely, she can walk, but she couldn't run. So I don't remember seeing any sign of rehab people who could probably have to dart the deer and then maybe set the leg or something.
Okay.
Yeah, Dave, Dean, thanks for your question. If you were to check our website, again, www.dec.ny.gov, and look for injured animal, you'll find a list of wildlife rehabilitators. You can actually search that by the type of animal and the county that you live in. And so that's available. It's actually an important link for this time of year as we start coming into premature yet, but later this spring as we start to have a lot of young wildlife, people tend to find animals that they think are abandoned, whereas in most cases they're just separate from the female for a little while. Having some contact with wildlife rehabilitators is helpful at that point. For this particular circumstance, we don't rehabilitate adult deer. It's a really hard process for the rehabilitator and not likely to be as successful. As you've observed, that deer are inhibited, sure, but certainly quite capable of surviving even with three legs. And so even though it seems to be unfortunate for the deer, I suspect as you continue to watch it, it'll do quite well.
Dean.
Yes.
You have a follow-up.
Okay. No,
that's good.
Was wondering.
All right, man. Well, thank
just,
yeah, keep an eye on it. Of course, you know, it makes
sure
it more vulnerable.
I know there are people who will take in injured animals.
Yeah, we have quite a lot of wildlife rehabilitators in the state. So
but not for deer.
Thanks for your question, Dean.
All right, thanks a lot. And by the way, it wasn't a problem for Dean, but if you're listening, and then we get to your call, just turn your radio down. It really helps us understand what you're saying. Let's go to Robert in Ashfield, Mass. Robert, you're on.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so my son is building property next to my house, and we had to put up a turtle fence for, I think it's a box turtle or a woods turtle. I think they may be the same. And I was wondering, we're like a quarter mile away from the nearest river. What are those turtle? And we've never seen a turtle there in 26 years on that property. What's the deal? Like, how far can those turtles go? It's a very expensive proposition to put up these fences.
Yeah, so box turtles and wood turtles are two different species of turtle. They are terrestrial turtles, so they're a little different. When you think of waterways, you're thinking bog turtles, musk turtles. These box turtles, wood turtles, they can persist in these terrestrial environments. They don't require water bodies. So you could be 5 miles, you could be 50 miles from the nearest water body, and you could still have those box turtles and wood turtles. They do quite well in the absence of water.
Robert.
So what determines the area that they considered an area? I could see the map, and it's only the maps are about a quarter mile away from the river.
So it's usually some quantification of the quality of habitat. So it might be the type of forest cover you have or the forage base. I would suggest reaching out to your regional wildlife officer or biologist to get their opinion on it as well, just because I'm not exactly sure what you're experiencing. So I would recommend you reach out to Mass Wildlife.
All right, Robert.
All right, thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. It's 800-348-2551 if you want to talk wildlife with Jeremy Hurst and Dave Kramer. Jeremy, what you working on right now?
I'm talking with you. It's working great.
When you go back to the office, what are you working on?
Oh, this time of year, we are working on reports for our federal grants and getting the next grants ready. My world is removed a little bit from the day-to-day wildlife unless I'm here.
That doesn't sound like that much fun.
Well, it's necessary, right? It helps us do all the work that happens out in the field.
But it doesn't sound like that much fun.
Somebody has to do it.
Yeah, you're not going to say anything. David, what are you up to?
We're just wrapping up our harvest summaries for black bear and deer, and we're starting to put together our moose conservation plan that we'll have out sometime this year for the public.
Now, if you went out and did those moose calls out in the wilderness, out where the moose run free, will they come to you?
Maybe. It's possible. Our densities are pretty low, so it's pretty low chance.
All right, so let me rephrase this. If there were a lot of moose around, would they be attracted to the sound?
Very likely.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, that's so cool. Number here is 800-348-2551. Jeremy Hurst and Dave Kramer are here from the New York State DEC. Terry's in Steventown. Hello, Terry.
How you doing? I have a question regarding the Adirondacks.
Okay.
Why are they doing away with the logging communities? It seems to be counterproductive to wildlife production and natural habitats. It
okay.
also is impacting the guiding hunting camps and impacting the finances of the locals that have survived in those communities for years.
So, Terry, I think what you have said is a good question, but I do want to say that these guys are wildlife biologists and not necessarily politicians. So if they don't answer fully, it's okay. Dave, you want to say something?
Yeah.
That's okay.
No, you're good. I do want to address it. So there is what's called the Forever Wild Clause. It's in the state constitution of New York. And within that clause, this was created, I can't recall the year, but shortly after the degradation of the landscape up there. But the clause states that any public lands within the Adirondack Blue Line cannot be sold or leased to timber harvest. And so there is that barrier to timber harvest on public lands, but that doesn't preclude harvest on commercial lands. So some of it is just a lot of the landscape is public and therefore is inaccessible to timber.
Jeremy, you want to add anything to that?
Well, Terry, what you might be referring to is over the last couple decades, there's been, you know, changes in the industrial market for timber production. And some of the large landowners that have historically managed their timber harvest in the Adirondacks have basically chosen to sell their land to the state, put it on the open market, and then it's been bought through open space conservation funds and and converted to the state. So there has been that pattern that's happened, and that's, of course, reduced timber harvest across the Adirondacks, and it does have some impact on tax base and some other things.
Terry.
Sounds good.
Thanks. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Steve in Berlin, or Berlin. Steve, go ahead.
Hi. I'd like to know what the population, what's going on with the beavers. When I was growing up around Berlin, they were seldom, and they were really infrequent. Now it just seems every place I look, they're all over the place. What is the story with them? Are they becoming a nuisance item, or is I just seeing them happen to be in a chosen area for them?
Copious Berlin beavers. What do you think, fellas?
Well, beaver populations have grown, and that's, you know, you're seeing the outcome of that. The reasons for that growth is that their harvest and their mortality levels have been lower. And so can they be a problem? Well, sure, if they're backing up culverts at flood roadways or flood crop fields. And so we have permitting systems in place that allow landowners to take beavers that are creating hazardous conditions on their properties or threatening properties and so on. And of course, the highway authorities have access to remove some beaver dams when that's necessary.
So you could take it. Does that mean you can kill it and sell the pelt?
So if it's done through the regulated trapping season, they can take possession of the animal and keep the pelt and sell the pelt. For animals that are removed for nuisance purposes through a nuisance wildlife control operator or for an individual landowner taking a beaver, we ask them to dispose of the carcass.
All right, Steve, you want to follow up?
I just wanted to know what the total population, whether it's really becoming, are they seeing more of a nuisance factor now? I mean, as a kid, I thought they were pretty rare and unique, but now every time I look at a trout stream, I look about any place, and there's a beaver dam or a beaver hut. They just seem to be thriving.
Yeah, and they're doing
quite
well.
I'm just wondering what you guys thought.
Yeah, for sure. Beavers are doing quite well. And certainly individual beavers, depending on where their activity is, can create some hassles for people. And so those circumstances we deal with on a case-by-case basis, but beavers overall are doing quite well.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. This email from Mary in Salem. Brush hogging season? Question mark. I have a 10-acre field that hasn't been used for grazing or haying for at least a decade. 2 years ago, it was brush hogged in late autumn. I'd like to brush hog it again this year with the goal of bringing the field back into grazing land. If I brush hog it now, will I be completely ruining the nesting habitat this year for birds and other critters, or will they come back after the cutting and rebuild again in the summer?
Yeah, so you're likely to do some degree of disturbance, but I don't know if there's a better time to do it. So I think you'd be all right. I'd do it sooner rather than later, just because come late May to mid-June, you're going to have fawns, and then you have fawns that might be taking cover. So sooner rather than later, you might push out some birds now, but they'll come back.
All right.
Yeah, and the good thing about doing it now is you would be cutting down the dead growth and maybe any woody growth that's coming up in the field before the grasses really start to grow.
Yeah.
And then, of course, come late May or early May, rather, we'll start seeing some of those native grasses coming back and forbs growing up in the field. And so some of the nesting structures that the birds will be using, they'll be there in May and June. They'll be growing back this spring.
And once again, Mary in Salem, you could always try this question with the bird people next week as well on Tuesday. We often talk about that exact topic on the show. All right, Dave Kramer, once again, tell us about Snapshot NY. We have about 10 seconds. How do people get involved?
Yeah, we have a website, www.snapshotny.org. It's a wildlife monitoring program where you can set a trail camera in your yard, and we'd love to see the wildlife you have, and that'll help us with the way we monitor wildlife going forward.
All right, 4 seconds. Jeremy Hurst, anything pithy to say?
Hey, enjoy the wildlife. It's a great time as animals are about to start breeding season and migrating back into the state.
Smoothly done. Well, thank you both for being here. Support comes from Berkshire Taconic Community Foundation. From scholarships to grants to personal giving plans, Berkshire Taconic Community Foundation, connecting local generosity to help create local opportunity. Learn more at berkshiretaconic.org. The Devlin Inn and Suites, Main Street, Lake Placid, welcoming families, athletes, and groups to the historic Olympic Village with Adirondack Mountain views and dog-friendly accommodations. TheDevlinNY.com to learn more. At Capital Roots, celebrating 50 years of helping make local food and green spaces accessible to all through mobile markets, community gardens, and programs, CapitalRoots.org.
Once again, thanks to Jeremy Hurst and Dave Kramer of the New York DEC for being here today. Great job, fellas. Thanks for the calls and the emails. Thanks to our engineer, Mr. Mike Bowen. Thanks to Ed Rosen for screening the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Oh, this is good. We'll talk about viruses that'll kill you tomorrow. We'll welcome back virologist Eric Yeager from the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. It's always a happy-go-lucky time when Eric comes and we talk about deadly viruses. We'll see you tomorrow at 2:00.